Supporting WHYY Germantown Friends School. Learning is for life. This idea is at the heart of Germantown Friends School, where the years from kindergarten through 12th grade are viewed as just one chapter in a long learning adventure. At GFS, the sense of the power and value of education defines the daily work. Students learn that the world is theirs to experience, to understand, to create, and to change. Learn more about the GFS K through life mission at an open house on Wednesday, November 11th, 8:15 to 11 a.m. Reservations at germantownfriends.org.
46 journalists at the Philadelphia Daily News, Philadelphia Inquirer, and Philly.com got pink slips today as the company downsizes to save money. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Dave Davies starts us off.
Dana DiFilippo has worked at the Daily News for 16 years. She's done breaking news, investigative stories, and won awards. She was stunned when she was summoned to editor Michael Day's office and told she's losing her job.
I didn't even stay to sign off my computer. I just left, and it's really not fun to have to hug people that you've, you know, worked for together with for so long. Goodbye.
Union President Howard Gensler says the layoffs aren't apportioned equally among the company's properties. The Inquirer, with the biggest staff, is losing 12 jobs, while 17 are gone from the Daily News and another 17 from Philly.com.
While the company has talked a good game about trying to transition itself into a digital company, they've basically gutted the digital operation.
The company announced last week it would be reducing staff and combining news gathering operations into a single newsroom so it can save up to $6 million. David Boardman, dean of Temple School of Communication, says he knows how painful layoffs can be, but he says they're necessary for the survival of the enterprise.
So, for instance, you're not sending two guys to cover a Phillies game for two different newspapers. You know, that's not a particularly efficient or smart thing to do, unfortunately. And now they'll be able to use those resources in a different way.
Boardman says even after the cuts, this will still be one of the largest newsrooms in the country. A company statement says it's engaged an outplacement firm to help those losing their jobs find new ones. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Philadelphia Mayor-elect Jim Kenney is making universal pre-K for all 3- and 4-year-olds in the city his top priority. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports that Kenney took that message directly to those who would be most affected by such a move.
The day after winning the general election, Kenney returned to a South Philly elementary school he visited on the campaign trail. One kindergartner asked him a pretty pointed question. What can mayors do for kids? Kenney responded,
the best we can.
The little boy shrugged. Kenney told reporters he wants to roll out his universal pre-K plan by September 2016. But first, he'll start with the city budget. That's where he plans to start looking for the $60 million he needs to fund it. Kenney says his team has already been considering using vacant schools to house new pre-K programs and talking to providers about adding more seats to existing schools.
We've been talking with a bunch of different people and organizations and groups to try to put this all together. We're going to get it done. I mean, that's the only thing I could tell you. And in January, we'll get started.
Kenney says he'll announce the names of major staffers before Thanksgiving, including the chief education officer who'll help him execute his pre-K plan. He also launched a website and plans to hold town hall-style meetings to get input from Philadelphia residents about what they want to see from the Kenney administration. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
And beyond the mayor's race, yesterday's Pennsylvania Supreme Court election could have wide-ranging implications for a number of high-profile cases related to education. As WHYY's Kevin McCoy reports, 3 Democrats swept the open seats on the state's highest court, shifting the balance of power 5-2 in their favor.
The newly constituted Supreme Court will face a few big questions related to education. Has the state been living up to its constitutional promise to provide all students a thorough and efficient education? Is that even a decision the courts can make? And if so, what can it do to compel state government to do better? For Philadelphia, big cases loom regarding the powers of the School Reform Commission. Can it unilaterally break its contract with the teachers' union? Can it suspend the charter law and unilaterally limit the number of students who go to a certain charter school?
I don't think it would be arguable that we're likely to see a transition in the court that may look more favorable to individuals with cases on education spending, on environmental issues. You get my point.
Terry Madonna is a Franklin and Marshall College political scientist. Add to that list, he says, the causes of unions who put big money behind Tuesday's winners. That's Superior Court judges Christine Donahue and David Wecht, and Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas judge Kevin Dougherty, brother of local electricians union boss John Dougherty.
You think you pour millions of dollars into campaigns and it's all benign? It's about good government and civics? No, you expect a favorable hearing. Does that mean you get everything you want? No, of course not.
For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCrory.
Think back for a moment on your college years, specifically weekends. What comes to mind? Football games? Frisbee on the quad? Perhaps the occasional adult beverage? Well, for many, the most formative and memorable college experiences take place outside the classroom, and research shows on-campus engagement can drive student achievement. But embracing the college experience can be tough, as Avi Wolfman-Aaron reports from the Delaware desk. He's been chronicling the experiences of several first-generation college students.
It's a Friday night, 11 p.m., about the hour when college campuses around the country spring to life. Sierra Jefferson, though, is happy just to be getting away.
As I'm getting everything in the car and I'm on my way home from work, like, I'm just very excited.
Sierra is one of five first-generation college students I'm following during their first years. Each has been recording audio diaries about the transition to higher ed. Sierra recorded this entry as she left her campus job selling tickets at a box office at Wesley College in Dover.
I'm just really, really excited to go home after a long week of school and a long week of studying, just a sense of a break of not being in the college or not being on campus and not being in the dorms.
Sierra's family lives about an hour away in southern Delaware. These little Friday getaways have become a ritual for her. Since starting school in August, she's returned home every single weekend. And she isn't alone. Through the first part of the semester, all of the students in our project have been going home regularly on the weekends. And it made me wonder, why?
Mostly just to get a break from being here. Like, this place is really, it's not a bad place to be. But you kind of can get tired of it really quickly. Like, I can get tired up here much more quickly than I can get tired at home.
That's Jada Smack, also from southern Delaware. She's attending Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, and when I first met Jada over the summer, she told me she'd been itching to leave her hometown ever since she was five. She wanted to travel, study international politics. But during the first 5 weeks at Swarthmore, she made the trek back home to Millsboro, Delaware twice.
Like, I just have all this free time, and I can just do whatever I want to do. So, like, if I just want to go home, I can go home. But, like, it's just because I don't have all of those, like, commitments that you think about when you go off to college.
Jada likes Swarthmore, but she talks a lot about how she hasn't found her thing yet, like the subject she's really good in or the club she really loves. Plus, campus life at a college known as a pressure cooker can be overwhelming. Even little things, like a conversation about politics, can make her feel unworldly or even unworthy. Home provides comfort and a chance to reconnect.
I've seen people leave and go to college and do all these great things for themselves and then forget who they are and forget, like, where they came from and go back and act like they're too good for their family. And I just want to go back and, like, remind my family that that's never going to be me.
Researchers have a name for this dynamic. Family achievement guilt. It's the notion that first-generation students actually feel guilty for surpassing their parents academically. They may wonder why they've been given this great opportunity while others at home are still struggling. Or they may, in Jada's case, want to reassure family members that success won't change them.
Like, I don't feel guilty for going to college, but I kind of feel guilty for leaving when, like I need to maintain a relationship with my family.
And this need to keep family close, it runs counter to the whole college ethos. These 4 years are supposed to be the proverbial time of your life, that moment when you find yourself detached from your childhood world. But first-generation students don't always have those expectations, says Rebecca Covarrubias, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
When we ask them about their motives for attending college, these tend to be more interdependent motives. I'm here to bring honor to my family. I'm here to help my community, compared to middle-class students.
In a 2012 study, Covarrubias found that those middle-class students saw college as a place for self-discovery and self-promotion. So too did administrators. The whole college atmosphere projected these middle-class values, and the cultural mismatch actually seemed to hurt the working class and first-generation students.
But what's interesting is that over a two-year period of time, these interdependent motives actually predict lower grades in college, right? So it suggests that when you mismatch the culture that's in the college setting, it actually works to your disadvantage.
For Sierra Jefferson, the academics haven't been hard, but grasping this notion of independence has been. Put simply, family matters to her.
I miss the food, the home-cooked meals. My dad, he would come and wake us up in the morning if we're not, up and early on his time. Just him being there, knowing he's there.
Sierra is already thinking about commuting from home next semester, maybe even transferring in the future. Research shows that students involved in campus life are more likely to persist and prosper in college. The benefit is even greater for first-gen students because campus networks allow them to build the social capital they often lack. Problem is, first-generation students are less likely to get involved in the first place.
Yeah, I am very homesick. But, I mean, I go home every weekend, so it's not too... And I'm not that far away, but I don't know what I would do if I was any further.
Sierra is starting to warm up to campus life. She's still going home on the weekend, but she's found a group of friends and at least considered joining a sorority. Jada has made strides, too. She's joined a club, become manager of the women's basketball team. Swarthmore, she says, is starting to become more familiar, almost like home. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Turning to this evening's headlines, a Pennsylvania judge is demanding that Attorney General Kathleen Kane attend a closed-door hearing. She'll be questioned under oath about any leaks by prosecutors or a judge of secret grand jury material from the Jerry Sandusky child sexual abuse investigation. The order issued today by Judge John Cleland says that he and Sandusky's attorney will question Kane tomorrow afternoon at the Pennsylvania Judicial Center. A new poll of New Hampshire voters shows New Jersey Governor Chris Christie moving up in the GOP presidential primary. The WBUR public radio station poll puts Christie in fifth place with 8%. That's up 6 points since September. The survey of 400 likely GOP primary voters finds Donald Trump atop with 18%, Ben Carson on his heels at 16% support. The poll's margin of error is nearly 5%. 64 degrees, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Turning partly cloudy overnight, falling back to 56 degrees. Tomorrow, a 30% chance of showers. Thursday's high around 70. Still ahead, a poet's memory of arguments between her parents fuels the creative capacity to write.
That sat with me for over 20 years, and I've always wanted to write my mother's story.
Philadelphia artists Ursula Rucker and Tim Motzer in conversation and performance as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
The recession ended 5.5 years ago. Unemployment is down, growth is up, but how does the economy feel?
We are extending ourselves a lot, but you know, you have to take a risk and work hard to make it in this country, and so that's what we're trying to do.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our new series, My Economy, next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
Coming up next on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Clairton, a small, hilly city on the Monongahela River near Pittsburgh, has been in Pennsylvania's Distressed Municipalities Program for nearly 3 decades. Now, having alleviated many of its financial problems, Clareton wants state oversight to end, but many residents say the city is as distressed as ever. Recovery looks different on paper than on Main Street in many distressed communities in the state. Keystone Crossroads' Irina Zhorov reports.
Roger Mount has been a barber for 20 years, and for the past two has had a shop in Clareton. He does what he calls old-school barbering, using a straight razor to shape beards and hairlines after he trims them down with a buzzer.
When you're cutting hair like this, it's like an art. You know, you try to make a bad look good. You're sculpting a whole new face.
Business has been okay, but it's mostly because clients have followed him from his previous shop. He says his taxes and operating costs, like sewage fees, are really high. As he talks about Clareton, it's like he's taking a straight blade to the city, too.
It's a dilapidated, old town that needs to be revitalized.
That sentiment is not unique. Up the hill in a different part of town, Althea Dreer is hanging out in front of a clothing store that's in the process of shutting down. She grew up here, left, came back to care for her mother, and says if she could, she'd leave again.
We don't have a grocery store here. We don't have anything here. You know, the kids don't have nothing to do around here but stay in the trouble, you know. There's no jobs here, nothing.
To go grocery shopping in a neighboring municipality, she says she calls a jitney, which can cost her $30 or more. Buses from town don't go directly to grocery stores. The 2009 to 2013 American Community Survey estimated unemployment at more than 14%. About a quarter of properties are blighted, though some demolition work has started. More than half of Clareton's population at its peak has left since the local steel industry began its decline.
And it's a depressing place, you know. It's very depressing.
Over and over, locals appeared incredulous at the idea that Clareton could shed its distressed city status. Just walk down the street, they said, citing the many boarded-up businesses. We asked Mayor Richard Latanzi if it felt like the city was recovering.
Only because I'm privy to the numbers.
Clareton couldn't make payroll and sustain its police force in 1988, so it entered Act 47, the program that provides state oversight and otherwise unavailable revenue streams to help municipalities improve their finances. Recovery has been inconsistent. As recently as 2009, the city was once again on the verge of not being able to pay its employees. Since then, it has downsized and professionalized municipal staff, collected delinquent taxes, adopted a new comprehensive plan, and sold its sewer system for nearly $10 million, which will go into the town's coffers over the next two decades. Last year, Clareton had a surplus of nearly $400,000 in its general fund. But Latanzi gets people's apprehension.
I think the people in Clareton just gave up and said, hey, it is what it is. But now for us to say, hey, we can do better and we're going to be a winner, it's going to take a little bit of proof in the pudding for them to believe.
It doesn't help that some of the very things that righted the city's finances are hurting residents' budgets. Since the sewer system sold, for example, residents have been paying a $50 flat fee. That's in addition to regular sewage bills each month. For many, that's a burden. But Michael Foreman, the state's Act 47 coordinator for Clareton, says as long as the government's finances are in order, the city can move forward.
The removal of the Act 47 designation, I think, would also remove the stigma of being designated as an Act 47 municipality to the outside world.
He says without the stigma, the city can refocus on economic development, things like attracting and growing new businesses, new jobs, new amenities. That stuff takes a really long time, he says. So, after nearly three decades under Act 47, it's like Clareton is just starting its real recovery, its search for a post-industrial future. Irina Zhorov, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. To see photos and hear more from Clareton residents, check out KeystoneCrossroads.org. Longtime Philadelphia-based collaborators, spoken word recording artist Ursula Rucker and guitarist Tim Motzer will perform Friday as part of the city's First Person Arts Festival, and they join me now on Newsworks Tonight. Tim, Ursula, having performed worldwide and recorded on countless projects in who knows how many studios, welcome to our space at WHYY.
Thank you. Glad
Thanks.
To be here.
Great to be here.
This specific performance Friday is apparently called My Father's Daughter. Explain.
Well, My Father's Daughter is
really from a little conversation that happened between my father and mother many years ago. And my father was arguing with my mom, and he looked at me. I was sitting on the couch in the middle like I usually was. And he said, oh, you're so much like me. You're your father's daughter. And my mother said, oh, well, what about my father's daughter? You never took care of her. And from that moment on, which was about, you know, over 20 years ago now, that sat with me for over 20 years. And I've always wanted to write my mother's story, and I knew that I would call it my father's daughter.
Your style has been compared to, among others, Sonia Sanchez, Michael Fronte. Do you look to them or others as role models, mentors, or others
Sonia
for guidance?
Sonia Sanchez is my number one mentor. She's my artist mama. Michael Fronte, I also love. So I'm very honored and humbled to be put in a category with them.
Well, listeners won't be able to see their performance, but Ursula, you've obviously brought your voice, and Tim, your Dan Electro guitar and vintage Fender amp. I understand you have a time to play for us a little.
That sounds great to me.
What are you going to be performing?
This one is called Humbled. White cloud rivers ran through me. I felt them pass through my bones. Through liver and lung and stomach, washed me out into the big white cloud lake, and I floated. No knowledge of swimming, but I floated. Right between fear and mountains. Just beneath the blues and birds, right next to the sun and God. Humbled. The big white cloud lake, and I floated right between fear and mountains, just beneath blues and birds, right next to the sun.
I'm humbled to have you come into our space at WHYY. Tim, Ursula, thanks for being here on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having us.
Poet Ursula Rucker, guitarist Tim Motzer, they're going to be performing Friday as part of the First Person Arts Festival. Their performance is entitled My Father's Daughter. And the First Person Arts Festival is featured in this week's entertainment guide at newsworks.org, where you can hear much more of my conversation with Tim and Ursula. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Ever wonder what your genes reveal about your family's past? Join us tomorrow evening as students at Westchester University discover surprises locked away inside their own bodies. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
The School in Rose Valley, a progressive preschool through elementary school, supports WHYY.
Located on 9 acres near Media, Pennsylvania, SRV's balanced approach to education taps students' intrinsic motivation, features personalized instruction at every grade level, and emphasizes daily outdoor play. Hosting a family open house on Saturday, November 7th from 10 to noon. Details about the school in Rose Valley on their Facebook page or at theschoolinrosevalley.org.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, music that speaks the voice of America. The Philadelphia Orchestra and Yannick Nezet-Séguin perform Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, plus the world premiere of Hannibal's One Land, One River, One People, with choruses from around the community. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. November 13th, 14th, and 15th at the Kimmel Center, an American celebration with the Philadelphia Orchestra.